There are millions of missing girls in India. Estimates range between 30 and 70 million. These girls are missing because they are being aborted on the basis of their gender, in a country with a deeply entrenched preference for sons. The practice of female feticide, also known as sex selective abortion, is widespread in India and plays out not just among the rural poor, but among well-off, educated families in the major urban centres.
Journalist Geeta Aravamudan has been writing on this phenomenon of missing women for decades. Her 2007 book, Disappearing Daughters, has been translated into numerous languages.
In spite of the staggering statistics, Aravamudan says sex-selective abortion isn't getting the attention it deserves. The skewed sex ratio in India is already increasing violence towards women, and its long-term implications are likely to be devastating.
We spoke with Geeta in her home in Bangalore.
So you write that female infanticide is akin to serial killing, but female feticide is more like a holocaust, a silent and smoothly executed crime which leaves no waves in its wake. Could you just elaborate on the distinction between female feticide and female infanticide?
Female infanticide is a practice of killing girl children after they are born. And it was traditionally practiced among a couple of communities, not many, across India. And the reasons given by them were many. They said they wanted to protect their girl children from marauding invaders who might capture them and rape them and kill them. Or they felt that girl children were a burden. Whatever be the cause, it's inexcusable. But there were traditional methods of killing girl children in certain communities. In Gujarat, for instance, where they were mostly dairy farmers, they would drown the newborn girl baby in a pot of milk. And in Punjab, where they were mostly agriculturists, they would bury the newborn girl child in a pot, along with a lot of other things with her, and pray over the pot and say, "May you go to heaven and send down your brother." So that was a traditional method of killing in Punjab. And emotionally and visually, it's very difficult to imagine that a family could kill a child when it is born only because it is a girl. So my first introduction to this entire crime came in Uslampatty, where I had gone to see a woman had been arrested for killing her girl child. And though everybody had been aware of this practice for quite some time, this is the first time a formal arrest had been made. And I wanted to know why nobody had arrested a woman for killing a girl baby till then. And only when I went there, it was like being in, Through the Looking Glass, Alice in Wonderland's Through the Looking, everything was topsy-turvy. Everything that I held as something which is wrong. Suddenly, I could understand why they were doing it. You know, these women were doubly disempowered. They were poor, they were powerless, they were financially and physically powerless, and they were pressurized by their families to kill the girl children because of dowries, which they found very difficult to pay. So they were actually not at all remorseful about what they were doing. They were happy that they had sent their children off to a better world. I talked to hundreds of women at that time. I talked to a midwife who had actually sent off many babies. She would get paid more if she killed the girl child after delivery. She would get paid for a delivery. She gets paid more if it's a boy. And she gets paid extra if she has to dispose of a girl. So I was talking to these people and I was wondering, oh my God, this is really terrible. And then suddenly, in one of the villages, I came across this very brave woman. And what she had done was her child, her daughter Janaki, was only 15 years old. And she had delivered twin daughters in the hospital. And her daughters-in-law said, "If you bring these twin daughters and come home, we will not allow you to enter our house, or we'll get your husband married off to somebody else who can produce sons for him. So you should either kill off one or two of these, either both or one of these. But this lady, Chinnathai was her name, she just put the babies into a vegetable basket, put it on her head, grabbed hold of her daughter, put her in the public bus, all this one day after the girl had delivered the child, and brought her home. And told those in-laws of this girl, okay, you don't take her back, I will look after these girls. And so I thought it was such a brave act on her part. She didn't care about social stigma. So when I went there, she said, you know, I saved these girls, but I don't know how many girls I can save. There are so many millions dying out there. Then she said this. She said, yeah, to you it looks terrible that we kill children when they are born. But what about all those thousands of women in your big cities who go to clinics, test the sex of their child, and then abort them? Is that not also killing? Just because you don't see them killing the child after it's born, you think it's not so bad. So that's what set me thinking that this terrible crime that I was had come to write about now was nothing compared to the much bigger crime that was happening in the cities. And why was it bigger? Because it was much, much more widespread.
Female infanticide has a much longer history, but female feticide, sex selective abortion, is much more of a recent phenomenon. What's the history of that?
Right. Female infanticide no longer exists. There's been a lot of interventions from non-governmental organizations. A lot of incentives have been given to these very poor families to keep their girl children. So female infanticide has actually disappeared. There is no longer feticide, on the other hand, has spread all over the country. History of feticide is that around 1970, amniocentesis, which is a medical test to determine the health of the fetus, first came to India. The idea was that you take out a bit of the amniotic fluid, and that will determine will let you know whether the child has got any inherited disease, the fetus. But what happened was that through this amniotic fluid, you could also determine the sex of the child. And this is how it came to India, and the doctors caught hold of this particular aspect. And since there was no law against it, they widely started advertising, saying, find out the sex of your child. And in fact, why do people not want girl children? Because they're afraid that they'll have to pay dowry at a later stage. And because they're worried that the money from the family will flow away to another family. So this dowry, if it's an agricultural laborer, it may be 10,000 rupees, it's beyond his means. If it's a middle class person, it may be 1 lakh rupees, it's beyond their means. So, you know, it's always beyond the means of the people who are paying it. So they started advertising and saying, spend 5,000 rupees now to find out the sex of your child and save 50,000 rupees later because you won't have to pay dowry. And the Bombay clinics, everywhere, they were advertising it very freely. And in fact, some of the family planning experts started saying, you know, one way of restricting the family, because everybody wants to have a son, it's not wrong to want to have a son. So let the people have children with the sex of their choice. So therefore, they will restrict their family. So if you have a daughter and in between you have more unwanted daughters before you actually produce a son, it's all right to abort the unwanted daughters. That's what they were saying at that point of time. Already the sex ratio was skewed in India and it was becoming much worse. And it truly happened along with the scan. It was very easy to go get your scan done. The doctor could tell you whether it's a girl or a boy and you could take a decision. So even that, the PNDT Act slowly began to address that. So it was no longer legal to reveal the sex of the child. Then they started putting F or M on the scan result. Even that was banned. Then they found other methods. There are short code methods. You know, you can say if they say laddu, it could be a boy, and if it's in jilebi, it could be a girl. Or they say come back on Friday, it could be a girl. If they say come back on Tuesday, it could be a boy. So there was all these code words being used. So the net result is today we cannot do anything about this because there's no way of knowing. I mean, there have been sting operations, but still it's very difficult to catch people who are doing this. Secondly, the abortion may not be done in the same clinic where the sex selection is done. In fact, the Asian populations in the US have also got a sex skew because there too they are aborting their girl children. And it's perfectly legal in the United States to reveal the sex of your child. So they find out the sex of the child in the United States and they come and have perhaps an illegal abortion over here in India, because though abortion is legal for health reasons, for family planning reasons, and for a lot of other reasons, an abortion after the first term is illegal. But there are a lot of clinics who do it. And usually by the time the scan result is got and you are able to come and have the abortion done, it becomes an illegal abortion. In the UK too, it's happening. Asian populations are having sex skew because of this.
Just to go back to that issue of the dowry that perhaps underlies this whole issue, is it still as common as it was 20 years ago for all economic classes?
Yeah. Dowry, just like sex selection, is illegal in our country. We have a very strong anti-dowry law. But in spite of that, dowry is given and taken. It's a very intricate kind of thing. Sometimes it is not overtly asked. They may not say, but they might identify a girl who they feel that she will bring in this much. So, you know, whenever I talk to people and say, why do you even take the first step and give anything towards it? They say, you know, if I don't give dowry, I feel as if they might feel there's something wrong with my daughter, and that's why. And that boys, people also say that if they don't take dowry, they feel that, you know, something is wrong. So as long as this mindset exists, it's not going to go away. Overtly, if you ask any urban population over here, they say, no, we never give or take dowry. In our community, it doesn't exist. But if you look underneath, everybody gives or takes dowry in some form or the other. So this is the kind of thing that can happen even among very educated people. I've heard of educated doctors being beaten by their husbands because, you know, they didn't bring dowry. Yes, there are lots of families where, you know, it doesn't happen. But I would say it's the norm that dowry is paid.
So Amartya Sen has written, India is catching up with other sexist modern societies like South Korea and China in sex-selective abortions. It's a technological revolution of a reactionary kind. So I'm curious, how have technological advancements actually made this situation worse?
Right. Medical technology, which is actually meant to heal or to detect defects, has been contorted and misused to find out the sex of children. So right from amniocentesis, which was supposed to find out birth defects, to the scan, which is also supposed to be for the same purpose, to find out if the fetus is growing well, to this new DNA monitoring blood test, which is also supposed to find out if the child has inherited any inheritable diseases. In all those cases, it would be perhaps practical to abort the baby before it grows to a particular stage. But instead of that, all this technology is being used to detect only for one purpose, and that is to detect the sex of the child. After Disappearing Daughters came out, many American news channels rang me up and asked me, so you are pro-life and not pro-choice? So I said, it's a totally different topic altogether. This is nothing to do with pro-life or pro-choice. It is pro-woman. I mean, it is something which is anti-woman, the whole process of selecting the sex of the gender of the child.
Do you see there being dramatic consequences in the next decade or so in terms of men unable to find wives and perhaps the trafficking of women between states, poorer states to more wealthy states?
Definitely. It's already happening. In Haryana and Punjab, where the sex ratios have dropped below the critical 800 mark, anything above between 950 girls to 1,000 boys is a good sex ratio, because world over, more boys than girls are born. Anything below that is considered bad. But in places like Gujarat, it's below 800. And all India sex ratio is close to only 900. So you take 900 girls to 1,000 boys, multiply it by the population of India, and you'll realize what a huge gap there is. Already there's a very huge scarcity of brides. And so women are actually being brought from other states. They're being bought from poor tribal areas and used by these people. They're actually married, but I would say they're treated more like sex and domestic slaves, because they don't have the same rights as women who paid dowry and came. Recently, I gave a talk in Hyderabad, and an economist came and told me, I'm an economist, and I would say that it's a question of supply and demand. If there is less supply of women, won't they be valued more? So I said, actually, they're not commodities to begin with. And secondly, this is exactly the opposite is happening. So in Punjab, already there was, again, another old tradition where all the brothers in the family could marry one woman. It was called Draupadi. Draupadi was a character in the Mahabharata. She was a woman who was married to the five brothers, the Pancha Pandavas. But what is happening now, there are forced Draupadis in Punjab, because they can afford to buy one woman from a tribal area. She's forced to sleep with all the brothers over there, because they need to have a sexual outlet also, perhaps. And so she becomes the victim of that. And the children belong to the family. She doesn't even have rights to say which brother created this child. And she is treated as a domestic slave over there. And all this is going against the regular social norm, where people are very caste conscious. For instance, a Jat would only marry a Jat. Under normal circumstances, he would never marry below himself and go and marry a tribal. Now, having done that, brought the tribal, he treats her like a servant. And people think I'm mad, because when I talk about it and when I say, just take a look at the census figures, how do you know that girls are disappearing across the country? So they say, look at the schools, they're full of girls. Look at the roads, they're full of girls. There are schoolgirls here. I have daughters, he has daughters, you know. But you just take a look at the 0 to 6 age group in the census figures. In the 0 to 6 age group across the country, the figures are dropping. So how do we prevent people from thinking of daughters' economic burdens? Manmohan Singh, when he released our last census report, said this is a national shame that our sex ratios are becoming worse, and we should hang our heads in shame. I say it's not a national shame, it's a national tragedy, because we don't know where the answers lie. I'll tell you one of the reasons why I personally feel it's happening, because people take it as a personal decision to decide the nature and quantity of their family. I may decide to have 2 children. There's no coercion. The government may suggest that you have 3 children, but I may decide to have 4 or 2 or 1. That is my decision. In the same way, I should be allowed to decide whether the 4 or 2 or 1 are girls or boys. So talking about skewed sex ratios makes no sense to most of the people. I mean, it could be a very rich social urbanite, it could be a villager, it could be a middle class teacher or a working woman. She feels that her decision, it's her womb, it's her family, it's her money, and she has to decide. And they don't realize that it's affecting the national population in any way. Or sometimes, even if they are, they say, okay, Maybe, but I don't think my one small act alone in its solitary thing is going to affect. It is a combination of many other people. So you first talk to everybody else and then come and talk to me.
Yeah. On the one hand, you're presenting a very dire picture with an inconclusive ending. At the same time, I wonder whether you think any changes have occurred in the last 20 years in terms of gender equality.
There is a definite awareness, at least, that gender equality is important. It's necessary. One thing about India is we have very good laws which protect working women. And to think that women entered these spaces only by the 1970s, when we had no law at all. Today there's excellent law to prevent sexual harassment, equal pay for equal work. In fact, our maternity laws here are much better than the USA. The family system, which is at the same time the bane and the boon of India, because, you know, on one hand, it could be very restrictive and it could prevent you from becoming an independent person. But today, the family has evolved. Women were previously completely confined in the house, and they were not even educated. See, my mother's generation, they hardly got educated. They were married off by the time they were 14, 15. The next generation, the joint family split up and people started going separately, setting up nuclear families. Then they wanted educated wives, because an educated wife would help with small things like go and pay the electricity bill or take the child to school and listen to what the teacher says. She need not go out and be an economic wage earner, but at least she would help to hold the family together. The women used this opportunity, educated their girls and said, look, don't be like me, but go and become a wage earner too, so that your status in society goes up. So it's been small steps. It's from 1970 to 2012. We have come a long way. I have hope in this set of women who are educated, who are doing very well. And I'm hoping that they will bring up children who will in turn bring about a very big change. Change always comes from the middle class. It doesn't come from the upper class, or it doesn't come from deep down. What comes from deep down could be revolution. But this change of social mores, it usually is a middle class phenomenon, in my opinion. I think it'll come about. I mean, I have hope.
This piece was produced by Meera Sharma and Henry Peck.
This has been Almira Radio. Thank you for listening.